today, Gary Young, on how important black voters were for Joe Biden's victory and what their power means for the future of the Republican Party.
We did great with the African-American community, Selka. Remember?
After winning the 2016 election, Donald Trump thanked African-Americans for not turning out in bigger numbers.
And you know what else? They didn't come out to vote for Hillary. They didn't come out. And that was the big... So thank you to the African-American community.
His campaign has since been accused of actively seeking to deter 3.5 million black Americans from voting.
That these voters were analysed and categorised into a group called deterrents. Now, what they could then do with this group...
This year, the US experienced the highest turnout for over a century, and early voting data suggests that almost 9 out of 10 African Americans voted for Joe Biden. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does the growing power of black voters mean for the future of the Republican Party? Gary Young, it's lovely to have you back. You are now a professor at the University of Manchester and, of course, a longtime contributor to The Guardian. You've just written a long piece examining the history of voting rights and racism in America. But let's begin with the election we've just had. After such a divisive campaign, how did Donald Trump do with black and minority voters?
So the exit polls in America, I should say, first of all, they're not finished yet because they haven't been fully tabulated. And secondly, they're not great. But what it seems that he had some success in shaving off an element of the black and Latino vote. It's not entirely clear how much, but somewhat. And that kind of fact has been fetishized, really, to suggest that, you know, well, this race had nothing to do with it and he did better. You know, the only group he did worse among were white men. And there are two things to say to that. The first is that the exit polls are great and actually, you know, you wouldn't want to base a whole argument on that. But secondly, he was starting from a low base and he made an aggressive pitch for them. But ultimately, black, Latino, and Asian American voters overwhelmingly supported Biden.
Philadelphia is the largest. The city of Philadelphia now up to 81%. That tells you a lot of votes still out in a place that is voting overwhelmingly for Joe Biden. These are the
As we waited for the votes to come in, where were we looking for them to come in? Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Detroit, Las Vegas, Phoenix. Those are the places that won it for Biden, that put him over the edge. Detroit and Atlanta, African Americans are a majority. In Milwaukee, they outnumber white people, also true in Philadelphia. He overwhelmingly lost those groups, and it was those groups in the cities in particular that put Biden over the edge.
We're talking about 7 out of 10 Latinos, 7 out of 10 Asian Americans, and almost 9 out of 10 African Americans backing Biden, and with that support, almost certainly handing him the presidency. So is this a story of changing demographics in America that will be alarming for Republicans?
If you're a party that is almost exclusively, almost, not entirely and not everywhere, Texas is different, Florida is different, but if you are reliant on the white vote, then you're reliant on a vote that is shrinking. And if the way that you maintain that reliance is through racist messaging, then you are also alienating the groups that are expanding. They've only won the popular vote once since 1988. That's 32 years. So they become increasingly reliant on losing the popular vote and winning the Electoral College. That is not a kind of winning strategy going forward. Most kids under the age of 15 are not white. So it is a real problem. And I'm quite keen to point out demography is not destiny. There is nothing predestined. in being Latino or being black. That means you couldn't be right wing. And actually, George Bush, in particular, was very keen to have a kind of multiracial conservative party.
There is no denying the truth that slavery is a blight on our history, and that racism, despite all the progress, still exists today. For my party, there is no escaping the reality that the party of Lincoln has not always carried the mantle of Lincoln.
You know, he had Condoleezza Rice. He had one of the most racially diverse cabinets in American history. Doesn't, in my mind, make him a nice guy or a decent guy, but there is a version of diversity that fits quite well with neoliberal conservative politics. So it's not inevitable, but increasingly what they've decided to do is to make their appeals in kind of once coded, now not so coded, racial messaging. And that leaves them incredibly, incredibly vulnerable.
You've said demographics are not destiny, but American politics does have a very specific racial history. It's easy to forget that segregation was a reality within many people's living memory. When we're thinking about this election, how important is it that we think about it in the context of America's history when it comes to race?
The history of this is absolutely essential, because America was a slave state for 200 years, an apartheid state for the best part of 100 years, and it's only been a non-racial democracy for 55 years. And so if my kids, because my wife is American, if my kids want to learn about segregation, they only have to ask their grandparents. And the mechanisms that have been in place to prevent racism at the polls, in public places, are all relatively new. And so it's really not possible to understand this moment in isolation. America was built, among other things, on racism. It's like arsenic in the water supply. It affects and infects pretty much everything about American political culture. So, for example, the congressional districts, like our Commons constituencies, in most places are gerrymandered, and they're gerrymandered around race. By gerrymandered, I mean they are drawn by the politicians so that the politicians have as many black voters in one area as they possibly can, then they can take as many seats elsewhere. So it's kind of all predicted around race. It's not exclusive. There are other things going on in America, gender, class, just regular politics, region. But you can't understand America without understanding its racial history, not least because it didn't happen that long ago.
And in fact, we don't have to go very far back to find such blatant ways to stop black people voting that they effectively didn't have the right to do it at all. Tell me what barriers were in place as recently as the 1950s and into the 60s.
Well, in the South, depending on where you were, but in most of the South, it just wasn't possible. There would be tests that no one could possibly answer, that black people would have to pass before they were allowed to vote. Or in the most kind of ludicrous and daunting, they would give you a bar of soap and say, how many bubbles are there in this bar of soap? Or they would present a jar of jelly beans and say, you can vote if you can tell me how many beans are in this jar. And these were all seen to be ways of saying, well, you're not qualified to vote. And so people may know the movie Mississippi Burning. That's about three kids, two white from the north and one black, who come down to Mississippi to register voters in 1964, the Freedom Summer, and end up being shot dead by people who were working with the local sheriff, who were in the Klan. I remember interviewing a guy called Buford Posey. I would mention someone in the town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the kids were killed. And he would say, well, his daddy was in the Klan. He was white, Buford Posey. And I'd say, what about so? Well, he was in the Klan. And I said, okay, you're going to have to stop saying everybody's in the Klan, because I'm going to need to ask you, how do you know? And he said, well, hell, I was in the Klan. Everybody was in the Klan. That was an old big thing. And Buford Posey told me that it was only when he joined the army at 18 years old that he realized that it was illegal to kill a black man. That's where the South was within living memory.
You mentioned the Summer of Freedom, and that was during a tumultuous period for civil rights in the mid-60s. Take us back there and tell me how those barriers to African Americans voting were finally pulled down.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Kennedy's been assassinated.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
You've had the March on Washington, Martin Luther King, and the I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed.
You've had the Civil Rights Act has been passed in 64.
Congress passes the most sweeping civil rights bill ever to be written into the law.
But the right to vote was in the Constitution. It was actually that they couldn't exercise that right. And in Selma, attempts to register to vote had led to one activist being killed and a community being terrorized. And so leads to a massive protest in the Black Belt area of Alabama, which kind of connects Montgomery, Alabama, which is where Rosa Parks was kicked off the bus, through to Selma. John Lewis leads the march.
We're marching today to dramatize to the nation, dramatize to the world, that hundreds and thousands of Negro citizens of Alabama, but particularly here in the Black Belt area, denied the right to vote.
The civil rights movement march over St. Edmund Peter's Bridge, which goes into Selma. They get to the top of the crest of the bridge, and in front of them, all they can see is mounted Alabama State Police who tell them to go, to turn around.
Disperse, you are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church. This march will not continue.
And they stop to pray. They are stampeded by mounted police, whacked with billy clubs. It's a completely kind of obscene scene. And one has to remember this is during the middle of the Cold War. So not only is this obscene in its own right, it's also embarrassing while America is trying to lecture the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc about democracy. Here are these scenes of people who want to vote and can't. And so these scenes go around the world and they shock the world.
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.
A few months later, Johnson gets the Voting Rights Act passed. So 100 years after the Civil War, African Americans finally get consecrated in law their right to vote. That's how long it took.
It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
What did it mean for the two main parties that there was now going to be this huge surge in voting among African Americans?
Well, it shifted them completely. That the weirdly, the Democratic Party had been a coalition of Southern racists and Northern liberals. So all of the people who were involved in suppressing African Americans while they were trying to vote, they were all Democrats in the South. Lincoln, should not be forget, was a Republican who, you know, which is why the Southerners didn't like him and didn't like the Republicans. So what happens is when Lyndon Johnson passes the Civil Rights Act in 64, he says, we've lost the South for a generation. It's actually been two generations now. But he was right, that the Democrats had then lost the South for a generation. Actually, Lyndon Johnson was one of those Southern Democrats from Texas. Meanwhile, the Republicans decide, look, there's an opportunity for us here. We can make a coalition of white people in the South and white people in the suburbs of the North around whiteness, around kind of their sense of racial fear. But we have to be careful. We can't do what the Southern Democrats did and just throw around epithets and talk in a racist way. We are going to have to be careful. We are going to have to use a kind of coded racism. And that was called Nixon's Southern strategy, and explained it to his chief of staff. He said, you've got to start out from the recognition that the problem is really all about the blacks, and then you have to pursue that without actually saying it.
Dissent is a necessary ingredient of change. But in a system of government that provides for peaceful change, there is no cause that justifies resort to violence.
Reagan talked about welfare moms.
In Chicago, they found a woman who holds the record. She used 80 names, 30 addresses, 15 telephone numbers to collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans benefits for four non-existent deceased veterans' husbands.
George Bush Sr. ran the Willie Horton ad, which was about a black rapist who raped again while he was on furlough.
He allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times.
There's a picture of this very dangerous black man, and that was one of the ads. And even the Democrats played along with this. So Bill Clinton flew home to Arkansas during his campaign in 92 to oversee the execution.
I'm just going home.
Going to Arkansas?
Yeah, we've got an execution tomorrow.
He didn't need to do this. The execution of a partially lobotomized black man, Willie Ray Rector, who was so diminished in his mental capacity that for his last meal, he said he would save his dessert until later. So they all played it. Of course, Obama couldn't play it, but they all played this game.
Let's talk about Obama because, you know, it's comfortable and nice to think of his election as a landmark moment in a positive way, as the first African-American president of the United States in 2008.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright tonight, we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
But from reading what you've written, Gary, it seems to me that it was also an incredibly significant turning point when it comes to racism in a negative direction.
Well, very much so. And he says in his new autobiography, Promised Land, you know, Trump was a product of this kind of white anxiety about having this black man in the White House. And I would kind of go further. I don't think it was just that he was black. He was black. His father was an immigrant. His father was a lapsed Muslim at a time when America was losing its wars. He was mixed race. All of those things kind of meant that Obama embodied precisely the future that a significant number of Americans were scared of, because in 2045, white people would be a minority. And in 2012, ahead of the election between Obama and Mitt Romney, with the Republicans polling down to zero among African Americans, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said, "We are not generating enough angry white guys to stay in business in the long term."
And I suppose one way that you might respond to the fear of losing all support of African-American voters is to think about how you might appeal to those voters. But that wasn't the route that the Republican Party took at that time. In fact, in 2013, when Obama was losing hold of power in many ways, the Republicans had taken control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate the year before, there came a really key shift in terms of voting rights. And it actually happened in the Supreme Court. Tell us what happened.
That's right. In the case of Shelby, Alabama versus Holder.
Justice, do you think that racial discrimination in voting has ended? That there is none anywhere?
I think that the world is not perfect. No one, we are not arguing perfectibility. We're saying that there's no evidence that the jurisdictions that are called out by the formula are the places.
The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that key sections of the Voting Rights Act are obsolete, that they related to a South that no longer existed, they related to a problem, Southern racism, that was not what it was, and therefore it was no longer necessary. And they basically gut the Voting Rights Act, which means that from then on, certain states in the South didn't have to ask a higher court before they changed their voting rules. They could just do it. And within hours of that being passed, both Texas and Mississippi decide to implement voter ID laws, which are particularly onerous for the black and the poor and the young if you don't have a driving license. And in Georgia, they cut the number of polling places by 10%. And most of those are cut in minority areas. And right up until 2018, in the gubernatorial race, Mr. Kemp runs against Stacey Abrams, and he purges tens of thousands of voters on the simple basis that because they didn't vote last time or they haven't voted in the last couple of elections, they might be dead. And then he puts a whole lot of other registrations on hold for minor discrepancies, like they missed a hyphen in their name, or they have it in their name in one thing and not in another. He wins very narrowly by just 54,000, I think, 700 votes.
I acknowledge that former Secretary of State Brian Kemp will be certified as the victor in the 2018 gubernatorial election. But to watch an elected official who claims to represent the people in this state baldly pin his hopes for election on the suppression of the people's democratic right to vote has been truly appalling.
That big move that you talked about in 2013 came down to the Supreme Court. And in 4 years that Trump has been in power, he's not only changed the face of America's most senior court to make it a big conservative majority, he has also appointed 25% of senior federal judges, and 92% of them are white men. These are lifetime appointees. So the institutions that matter most in America have been stacked against minorities, haven't they, in a very short period of time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Trump's legacy, and if people are curious about, well, how can so many people vote for him when he says this and he acts like this and so on, it's because he delivered. He delivered judges, he delivered tax cuts, he delivered deregulation, and an awful lot, when it comes to voting rights, an awful lot of Trump's legacy will be in the courts, which is why one has to separate Trump, who is his own bizarre, idiosyncratic kind of creation, and Trumpism, which has a longer tradition which, you know, you could talk about George Wallace from Alabama in the 60s or any number of kind of racist characters in American history, that Trumpism is just a new name for an old thing. And that tradition will continue because he has been very effective in putting a certain group of people in positions of power. And the courts have quite a lot of power in America.
Coming up, given the Republicans have lost the popular vote again, will the party change its approach? Okay, Gary, what you are laying out is the ways in which Republicans have, over the years and decades, tried to overcome demographic shifts that have favoured the Democratic Party. But those demographic changes are becoming overwhelming. Them, along with a huge turnout drive, had a huge impact this month for Joe Biden. Ultimately, trying to stop black people from voting isn't going to be enough for Republicans. So what demographic picture are they looking at going forward? And how do you think that they will respond to that?
If Trump had gone down in flames, that would have been something different. But he didn't. Joe Biden won by 1% or less in several places. And so Trump wouldn't have had to have shifted much to have won. It's not like when it comes to their base, it's not like the Republicans have anything else going at the moment. It's not like there is no plausible, credible, viable resistance to Trumpism within the Republican Party. If you take Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator, who called Trump a kook when he was standing, but who is now kind of fully paid-up member. Republicans are afraid of their base. And so even though it's not a winning formula presidentially, and every kind of cycle it will get harder, it's also the case that they kind of, it's not like they have developed an alternative, although alternatives are out there, and alternatives were suggested in the past. So I think we're going to have to wait for the fever to break. But what he did was sufficiently viable, sufficiently competitive for Republicans, for the time being, certainly, to go with it.
And finally, is there also a real challenge here for Democrats? As you point out, it wasn't the landslide victory that they were hoping for. And while they did win, the overwhelming majority of African Americans who did turn out for Biden, almost a third of Latino voters and a third of Asian American voters, back Trump. I mean, you've talked about the reasons that this election result will worry Republicans. Do you think Democrats will be looking at some of the trends and feeling nervous?
I think they might. I think they might look at relative voter turnout, the absolute collapse in rural areas and things like that. But if I was a Democratic Party grandee, which is obviously never going to happen, I would be most concerned about the next 4 years, that they have to deliver something. And whatever they deliver, they have come in the middle of a pandemic, an economic depression and crisis, in a country where wages were already stagnating and people were already cynical. Biden has to produce something transformative. He has to change people's lives concretely. It won't be enough just to staunch the bleeding here. He has to do something big, which is why I mentioned Lyndon Johnson. There was nothing in Lyndon Johnson's past to suggest that he would be the transformative president that he was, who introduced Medicaid and Medicare and the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. But he starts his presidency with JFK's assassination. And he says, well, what is the presidency for? When he's told, don't go for civil rights, you'll never get it through, and so on. He says, well, what's the presidency for? Here was a man who knew how to reach across the aisle to do wheels and deals, to twist arms and so on, which is what Biden's MO is supposed to be, who didn't have a history of kind of being effective or campaigning particularly well on any of these issues, who ended up being, I would say, the most transformative president since the Second World War, notwithstanding Roosevelt. Biden is going to have to produce, because otherwise, in 4 years' time, everything gets harder. The cynicism grows, the disillusionment grows, and people once again look for someone who can disrupt the status quo and throw a Hail Mary pass. That's how Trump won the first time. If enough doesn't happen, believe it or not, there could be worse.
Gary Young, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Gary Young. Do read his brilliant writing on this. Go to theguardian.com and search for the long read, Counted Out, Trump's Desperate Fight to Stop the Minority Vote. If you missed Jonathan Friedland's interview with Barack Obama in Weekend, you can also read that, and do follow our Guardian US team as the fallout of the 2020 election goes on. That's it for today. My thanks to Gary Young, and thanks to you for listening and for all your reviews and tweets. We do appreciate your feedback. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.